doors, finally accommodating a line that snaked all the way across the Lefty O'Doul Bridge. Yet I could still hear the celebratory blasts of car horns, the constant buzzing of passersby, occasional chants of "Let's go, Giants!" and one determined dude, as punctual as a cuckoo clock, yelling the same phrase at the top of his lungs every 5 minutes. F yeah! There wouldn't be another baseball event at the ballpark until FanFest in February. The light standards were off. Nothing to see here. But for the fans milling about, it didn't seem to matter. Maybe they couldn't tell you why they were hanging around. They only knew they didn't want to leave. They were high on life, among other things, and that was to be expected. San Francisco had gone without a World Series championship despite so many Hall of Fame-studded rosters. Even Willie Mays and Barry Bonds, perhaps the two greatest all-around National Leaguers to ever put on a uniform, hadn't been enough. No matter what form it took or who achieved it, the first World Series title in San Francisco was sure to result in a joyous, momentous, overwhelming celebration. So on the night of November 1 in Arlington, Texas, when Posey caught the final pitch from Wilson that made the Giants champions, it was a moment that stirred the soul of an entire region. The Giants arrived home at 3 o'clock the following morning and were surprised that hundreds of people were there, waiting in the dark, for no other reason than to cheer and say thank you. The players hadn't seen anything yet. They understood what they had accomplished that night in Texas, but until their parade cars turned from Montgomery onto Market Street, they hadn't realized what it all meant. The players and coaches were blown away as they went along the parade route. They saw moving seas of orange-clad fans holding signs that conveyed thousands of messages of grace and gratitude. People flew from all over the country on short notice to be there. BART trains packed in fans and families from the East Bay like sardines, each car already full before they reached the stops in Oakland. San Francisco is no stranger to social movements. This is a city that unites for a common cause. And it is a city that knows how to party. These Giants brought out the best of both. But there was something extra with this team. They were San Francisco. This was a team that lived out loud, played hard, and partied harder. Lincecum would look right at home with a flower child headband, and Wilson had the most famous beard since Jerry Garcia. It wasn't just baseball fans who got caught up in this team. It was the entire city, from the Sunset to the Marina to the Castro to the Financial District, all finding a character who spoke to them or a player with whom they could identify. Even if your thing was half-naked men wearing leather S&M masks. We'll get to that, I promise. These were the people's champions. They were accessible and lovable, raucous and rowdy, a little bit kinky, and a little bit freaky. They were punk rock, classic country, and a whole lot of soul. This was San Francisco's team, and their clubhouse dynamic fit the city. They accepted outcasts. They tolerated a diversity of opinions and beliefs. They played hard for themselves and for each other. And in the end, they nailed it. No year stands alone, though. For these Giants players, coaches, and executives, the 2010 season was a place in time in which their fates intersected and their individual stories reached an epic arc. As I look back on this group of World Series winners, so many things stand out. Sure, they stood in fourth place at the All-Star break and overhauled their opening day lineup during the season. But more than anything, I'm struck by the number of compelling characters who populated their roster. As a beat reporter, I'm not supposed to root for wins or losses. But there's no harm in hoping for good stories to write. And the Giants provided no shortage of them. There was Huff, the charming rogue, whose famous unmentionables were first mentioned in my Extra Bags blog. No, I never envisioned that one of my biggest journalistic scoops would involve a 33-year-old Texan and his butt floss. There was Torres, the career minor leaguer, who refused to give up on himself and inspired his teammates time after time. There was Juan Uribe and his joyful spirit that needed no translation. There was Wilson's uniquely odd personality and even odder television interviews, Burrell's second chance, and Ross's whirlwind of a postseason. There was a brilliant rotation, from Lincecum's carefree brilliance to Matt Cain's zero-tolerance mound presence, to Jonathan Sanchez's boldness, to rookie Madison Bumgarner's unflinching gaze. And in the end, there was perhaps the most